We often assume that the path to massive business success is, well, a fight, right? It's this sort of bloody, brutal battle for market share. You know, sharpen your knives, ruthlessly undercut rivals.
Yeah, compete like crazy within these existing well-defined industries. That's pretty much been the definition of strategy work for, what, the last few decades?
Exactly. It's all focused on outcompeting rivals within those existing crowded waters. And those crowded waters are what we're calling the red oceans.
That's it. Red oceans represent, well, basically all industries that exist today. They're saturated markets.
Right.
Growth often just means stealing market share from somebody else. It's necessary work sometimes, but in a world where supply increasingly outstrips demand, just fighting for a shrinking slice, that's not where the really exclusive growth is.
So the red ocean is the status quo. It's like this market jungle where everyone's fighting. Mm. What happens if companies just stay there? If they were to escape that carnage?
Well, often they stagnate. Or worse. Our mission today, really, is to figure out how to escape that cycle. How to venture into what we call the blue ocean.
Okay. The blue ocean.
The blue oceans are the inverse. Think uncharted market space. These are industries maybe not even in existence today. Or existing industries that get radically recreated. The goal isn't competition. It's creation.
Creating new demand.
Exactly. Generating new demand, leading to opportunities for high profit, and basically making the existing competition irrelevant.
Making the competition irrelevant. I mean, that's the dream, isn't it? But creating a whole new market space, it sounds like. I don't know, pure luck. Or maybe just high risk, wishful thinking. If it's really systematic, why aren't more companies doing it?
Yeah, and that's the perception we kind of need to dismantle today. We're showing you the systematic frameworks, the tools that turn that high-risk thinking into, well, an actionable methodology. And the cornerstone of this whole approach is something called value innovation.
Okay, value innovation. Let's unpack that. Sounds a bit like a marketing buzzword, maybe. What does it actually mean?
It's not just buzz. It's a specific strategic logic. It focuses on creating a leap in value for both the buyers and the company itself. So it fundamentally breaks that, you know, age-old trade-off in strategy.
Ah, the idea that you have to choose.
Right. That dogma that says you must choose between differentiation, which usually means higher value but higher cost, and low cost, which often means just reasonable value. Blue Ocean strategy says you pursue both simultaneously.
Differentiation and low cost.
Hang on.
If you invent some radically improved value proposition, won't your competitors just look at your success and copy your idea?
Yeah.
I mean, the ideas themselves, the knowledge, that's a non-rival good, right? Once your idea works, it's not hidden anymore.
That's a great point. And it's the central tension we really have to address today. The answer lies in the execution, the scale, the pricing sequence, which we'll definitely cover later. But first, let's look at how that value leap is actually achieved. Let's use probably the most dramatic example, Cirque du Soleil.
Cirque du Soleil. Yeah, that's the classic case study, isn't it? Because they entered an industry that was, frankly, pretty unattractive and declining. The traditional traveling circus.
Oh, it was in deep trouble. Traditional circuses like Ringling Bros, they were suffering from, you know, falling audiences, flat revenue.
And all the issues around using animals.
Exactly. Increasing public sentiment against animals. They were really stuck trying to cater only to children.
Right. And Cirque didn't just try to beat them at their own game. I remember their first production was titled, "We Reinvent the Circus." They didn't just, like, hire a funnier clown or find a bigger lion.
No, not at all. They shifted the target customer completely. They appealed to a totally new and highly profitable group, adults and corporate clients, people willing to pay a ticket price several times greater than a traditional circus show.
For a totally new kind of entertainment experience.
Precisely.
So how did they manage that massive leap in value and keep their costs down? This is where that systematic methodology of value innovation really comes into play, I guess.
It does. They used a really disciplined approach, simultaneously eliminating, reducing, raising, and creating elements of the offering. Look at the eliminations first. This is where the cost control happens.
Okay.
They eliminated animal shows. That's a huge operational cost right there.
Yeah.
Training, care, housing, insurance.
Yeah.
Massive.
Huge.
They eliminated star performers. You know, those big name ringmasters or daredevils. Hugely expensive, but honestly trivial next to Hollywood movie stars in terms of draw.
Right.
And they eliminated the three ring venues. That reduced the number of performers needed instantly, and it also got rid of that spectator angst. you know, feeling like you're missing something important in another ring.
Wait, so they basically traded these high-paid performers and expensive animal trainers for, what, lower-cost, maybe higher-value artistic directors and designers?
You've got it. It's a massive shift in who captures the value. It moves from expensive individual talent to the intellectual property of the production itself. That's a huge cost structure lesson right there. So what did they keep and enhance? Well, they kept the tent, that essential glamour of the circus, but they glamorized it. Comfortable interiors, more like a grand theater. They kept clowns, but they shifted the humor away from slapstick towards something more sophisticated and more enchanting. They actually reduced the overall number of acrobatic acts, making them more elegant, more artistic sequences rather than just, you know, feats of strength.
The creation element, that seems key. Borrowing from theater, which is like an alternative industry.
Absolutely. That's what defined the new experience. They created things like a unifying theme and storyline for each show. They used original musical scores. They injected this really strong artistic flair and, frankly, an intellectual element you just didn't find in traditional circus.
Right.
So by eliminating those high costs of the old model and creating these high-value theatrical factors, they completely broke the value-cost trade-off. They swam right into their own blue ocean. They created this new form of theatrical entertainment that just made the traditional circus irrelevant to their target audience.
Okay, that Cirque example gives us that real aha moment. But managers, you know, they need tools. Tools to replicate that kind of thinking without just depending on artistic genius. So the first core analytical tool we need to talk about is the strategy canvas.
The strategy canvas is, it's simple on the surface, but really powerful. It basically just plots a company's relative performance across all the key competitive factors in its industry.
Okay.
And when you plot all the major players on the same canvas, you often see this, well, this startling phenomenon we call convergence.
Convergence meaning... Everyone's basically doing the same thing, strategically.
Pretty much. They're all emphasizing and investing in the exact same factors,
yeah.
Often over-designing elements in this race to match and beat each other.
Doesn't that just suggest that most managers are, I don't know, maybe a bit lazy?
Right.
Or just too afraid to look outside their existing comfortable definitions of their industry?
It suggests they're definitely overly focused on their rivals, maybe to a fault. Look at the, say, the $20 billion U.S. wine industry back in the late 1990s. The strategy canvas showed that both premium and budget wines were following the same basic strategic profile.
Really? Even premium and budget?
Yeah. Heavy focus on prestige, complexity, you know, tannins, oak aging quality, all that esoteric winemaking terminology. They were all stuck in the same competitive rut, just playing at different price points.
That sounds like a Red Ocean classic.
Uh-huh.
Totally credit. So how do you redraw that canvas? How do you achieve divergence? You mentioned tools.
Right. You use the four actions framework. It's often called the ERRC grid.
ERRC.
Okay.
This is the really practical tool for shifting your value curve and achieving that simultaneous differentiation and low cost we talked about. The four questions are simple. Eliminate what factors that the industry takes for granted should be eliminated. Reduce what factors should be reduced well below the industry standard, maybe because they're over-designed in the race to compete.
Okay, eliminate, reduce. Those sound like cost drivers. Exactly. Then, raise what factors should be raised well above the industry standard. This is about uncovering and eliminating compromises that customers have been forced to make. And finally, create what factors should be created that the industry has never offered.
Got it. Raise and create, those are the value drivers.
You nailed it. Eliminate and reduce cut costs, raise and create, drive value up, and create new demand.
Okay, let's apply that framework. Let's use the wine industry example, specifically Yellowtail Wine from Casella Wines. Their Red Ocean context was that super competitive U.S. market dominated by complexity and tradition.
Right, and Casella achieved their Blue Ocean insight by looking somewhere completely different. At non-customers.
Non-customers.
Yeah, the vast mass of adults who drank beer, spirits, ready-to-drink cocktails, people who weren't drinking wine, they found these non-customers actively avoided wine because they found it intimidating, pretentious. All that complexity and terminology was a turnoff.
Ah, so the insight was simple. Make wine an easy, accessible social drink, not some complex puzzle.
Exactly. So how did they use ERRC? What did they eliminate to simplify things and cut costs?
Let's see.
They eliminated all that esoteric winemaking terminology, those distinctions based on vintage and aging qualities. Gone. They eliminated expensive above-the-line marketing, like fancy magazine ads.
Okay, and reduce?
They reduced the wine's complexity, fewer tannins, less oak, making it much softer. Mm-hmm. They reduced the wine range drastically, offering only two varieties initially, red and white, simple. And they reduced the focus on vineyard prestige and origin.
Right, strip it back. So what did they raise and create? What new utility did they offer that was instantly appealing to those beer and cocktail drinkers?
They created three really powerful factors. First, easy drinking. A soft, approachable taste with pronounced fruit flavors, really easy to like. Second, ease of selection. Simple, bright labels featuring that kangaroo. They really stood out on the shelf. No confusion.
Yeah, you couldn't miss it.
And third, fun and adventure. They positioned the product not as serious wine, but as a non-traditional, accessible, fun social drink.
The result was pretty remarkable, wasn't it? Yellowtail didn't just steal sales from other wines. It actually expanded the market by bringing in all those mass-market alcohol drinkers. It just completely bypassed the established rules of the game.
A perfect blue ocean move.
Finding these blue oceans, then. It isn't some mystical process. It's about having a structured approach, looking at familiar data, maybe, but from a new perspective. And that's what the Six Paths to Reconstructing Market Boundaries framework helps us do.
Exactly. And since we can't possibly cover all six paths in detail today, maybe we can highlight the two most immediately actionable paths for you, the listener.
Sounds good.
Okay, the first one is path one. Look across alternative industries. Alternatives are products or services that have different forms, different functions maybe, but they share the same overall objective or purpose for the customer.
Like going to a restaurant versus going to the cinema. Different products, but the same objective. A night out.
Perfect example. And NetJets is a great business case here. They looked at the alternatives for corporate travelers. What were the options?
Well, commercial airlines.
Right. Chosen mainly for cost control, predictability, perhaps.
Or owning your own corporate jet.
Chosen for utility. Speed, convenience, point-to-point travel, flexibility. Hugely expensive, though.
Right.
NetJets looked at those two alternatives and basically combined the decisive advantages of both.
They invented fractional jet ownership. You buy a share of a jet, share it with others, offering the high convenience and speed of a private jet, but at a fraction of the outright purchase cost. It became comparable to, say, first-class commercial travel, especially when you factor in the value of time saved.
And crucially, they delivered on the utility promise. Guaranteed access to a plane with just 4 hours' notice. Access to something like 5,500 airports versus maybe only 30 major hubs for commercial airlines. They didn't compete head-on with airlines or jet manufacturers. They created fractional jet ownership by looking across the alternatives.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second actionable path?
That's path two. Look across strategic groups within industries. Strategic groups are basically groups of companies within an industry that pursue a similar strategy, often ranked by price and performance tiers. Think luxury cars versus economy cars.
Got it. So this path involves understanding why customers trade up to a higher group or trade down to a lower one.
Exactly. You look at the factors that make people choose one group over another. Think about the fitness industry again and the creation of Curves Fitness Centers.
Oh, Curves.
Right. What were the existing strategic groups? You had high-end health clubs, expensive, maybe $100 a month. Full amenities like pools, saunas, juice bars, often seen as intimidating, especially with lots of men present.
Okay, and the alternative?
Cheap home exercise programs or videos, low cost but minimal instruction, easy to lose motivation, high abandonment rate. Curves looked at what women particularly were compromising on in both those options.
And they realized that many women, especially maybe time poor or less athletic women, didn't actually want the juice bars or the saunas.
Or the potentially intimidating atmosphere with men around while they were trying to exercise.
Right, so Curves eliminated all those non-essentials.
Eliminated the pools, the fancy locker rooms, even the men. And they created something new. A simple 30-minute hydraulic circuit training system designed specifically for women in a women-only environment.
Non-threatening, effective, quick.
And priced right, around $30 a month. It was hugely appealing. I mean, I didn't realize eliminating the sort of social element of men was such a core strategic factor there. That's fantastic utility for that specific non-customer group they were targeting.
It really shows that differentiation doesn't have to be about complex technology. Sometimes it's about radical simplification and just really focused utility. Curves grew like wildfire, appealing to that huge mass of women who had previously avoided traditional health clubs altogether.
Another blue ocean, created by looking across strategic groups, So having a great idea, spotting that opportunity, that's only the beginning, right? The next crucial step is validating it, making sure it's commercially viable. And that's done through the strategic sequence of utility, price, cost, and adoption. An idea has to pass all four of these hurdles sequentially.
Okay, first hurdle, utility. Does the idea actually offer exceptional utility? We have to avoid that technology trap, don't we? Where companies get obsessed with novelty, with cool tech that doesn't actually solve a fundamental problem any better for the mass of users.
Exactly. Novelty versus compelling utility. Think of Philips CDI back in the day, or Motorola's Iridium satellite phone. Technologically interesting, sure, but they lacked that compelling utility, the simplicity, the productivity boost, the reduced risk needed to attract the mass of buyers. They failed the utility test for the mainstream.
Okay, so if it passes utility, we move to price. And the key here is setting a strategic price, one that's accessible to the mass of target buyers. You mentioned using the price corridor of the mass.
Yes, and this is where we circle back to your earlier point about imitation, remember?
Yeah, competitors copying the idea.
Right. Since the underlying ideas, the knowledge, are often non-rival and easy to copy, you must aim to lock in high volume almost immediately. High volume generates higher returns, yes, but critically, high volume actively discourages imitation.
How so?
If you price your offering correctly from the start, comparing it not just to direct competitors, but to the alternatives the mass of buyers currently use, like Ford pricing the Model T against the horse-drawn carriage, not other cars,
Ah, right.
you capture the mass market quickly, you build scale fast. That makes it much less attractive, much less profitable for potential imitators to jump in later when you already dominate.
Okay, that makes sense. Which leads directly to the third hurdle, cost.
Yeah.
If the strategic price is set to capture the mass, we have to hit a specific cost target.
Precisely. And we use price minus costing. You don't cost it up and add a margin. You start with the strategic price needed to unlock the mass market, then you deduct your desired profit margin, and that gives you your target cost.
So you calculate cost backward from price.
Exactly. You don't let your current costs dictate your price. Price dictates your target costs. If you can't hit that target cost through streamlining operations or finding innovative partners, well, you might need a pricing innovation itself.
Like what?
Think about IBM leasing its expensive tabulating machines instead of selling them outright, or Blockbuster renting $80 movie tapes for just a few dollars. That allowed them to hit a strategic price point the mass market could afford while still covering their high asset costs over time.
Got it. Utility, price, cost. And finally, the fourth hurdle, adoption. This isn't just about customers buying in, is it? It's about overcoming resistance within the organization and from stakeholders.
Absolutely. This is about the internal politics, the inertia, the fear of change that can sink even a perfectly sound blue ocean idea. You know, if Cirque du Soleil had faced massive internal resistance from their performers about firing the star acts, the whole strategy could have failed right there. Execution is everything.
So the adoption hurdle is about managing stakeholder inertia, political resistance, which you often find is far greater in large organizations, whether they're commercial or public sector, than the actual market risk itself.
You see this resistance most clearly in places that fight change the hardest. A classic example is the NYPD under Commissioner Bill Bratton back in the 1990s.
Right. Crime was rampant in New York City,
Yeah.
but the budget was frozen, resources were tight. Bratton had to use what the Blue Ocean Strategy folks call tipping point leadership to overcome these incredibly deep organizational hurdles.
Exactly. Take the cognitive hurdle, for instance. How do you make 38,000 police officers actually feel the urgency of the crime problem instead of just reading sanitized statistics and reports?
What did he do?
He had to make them confront the worst reality directly. He forced senior staff, who usually stayed in headquarters, to actually ride the subway system themselves, get face to face with the aggressive begging, the gangs, the graffiti, the sense of disorder. That visual and emotional awakening made the case for radical change far stronger than any argument based on numbers alone.
Wow. Okay. And the resource hurdle. Frozen budget, yet they desperately needed to free up officers' time for patrolling the high crime areas, the hotspots. How do you magically create more officer hours without spending a dime?
He identified the cold spots where resources, particularly officer time, were being wasted. For example, officers were spending up to 16 hours processing a single arrest, transporting suspects downtown, doing paperwork.
16 hours.
Yeah. So he created buses, basically mobile booking stations, these converted buses, parked right outside subway entrances in high crime areas. They cut arrest processing time down to just 1 hour.
Incredible.
He freed up hundreds, maybe thousands of officer hours every single day from that one cold spot activity and refocus them directly onto patrolling the high crime hotspots, all without hiring a single new officer.
And that kind of operational transparency seems key to solving the motivational hurdle too, which he tackled with fishbowl management.
That's right, the famous CompStat meetings. Twice a week, precinct commanders had to show up and report publicly using charts and maps projected onto the wall to visually illustrate their performance. They had to explain exactly how they were addressing crime patterns in their areas.
So total transparency and accountability.
Exactly. Accountability was transparent. High performance was recognized and celebrated. Poor performance was exposed. It motivated the entire leadership team to really execute the new crime-fighting strategies effectively.
Okay, so this whole deep dive really shows that creating a blue ocean, it's systematic, it's actionable, and maybe counterintuitively, it's arguably less risky than just fighting tooth and nail in a crowded red ocean where everyone's constantly trying to match your every move.
Absolutely. I mean, history shows us there are no permanently excellent companies, just companies that make smart strategic moves, often creating blue oceans. The key is that continuous value innovation and recognizing that strategy creation can be systematic. It's not just random flashes of brilliance.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, as you think about your next big strategic move? We've established that the knowledge and ideas that often drive these blue oceans, like, say, Curve's workout concept or Cirque's elimination of animals, they're actually pretty easy for others to imitate once they're successful.
Yeah, the core concepts aren't usually patentable secrets. Therefore, the provocative thought we want to leave you with today is this. If your next great blue ocean idea can be copied, and probably will be if it works, how far must you push that initial strategic price down right from the start?
Down far enough, blue.
Down far enough to lock in the mass market volume and achieve economies of scale so incredibly quickly that imitation becomes simply unprofitable or at least unattractive for potential rivals. Is your execution strategy built around achieving immediate market dominance via price? Recognizing that maybe scale, not just the originality of the idea itself, is the ultimate long-term protection in a blue ocean. Something to think about.